Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, yes, Poetry Month is over. How about some more poetry? We've been collecting readings from the Seattle Arts and Lectures Poetry Series over the last 2 months. We're just catching up to them, presenting the works of poets Ellen Bass, Alice Notley, and Ross Gay. Each one spoke at Seattle's McCaw Hall. This presentation includes one poem from each of the three featured poets, and an introductory poem from three of Sal's writers and the school's poets. You'll find each full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thank you to Sonia Harris for our recordings.
To officially open our evening, I am proud to introduce a student from our Writers in the Schools program. This year, WITS will work with 26 area public schools and at Seattle Children's Hospital by matching them with local professional creative writers to inspire over 6,000 students to write their own poems, stories, memoirs, and comics. Tonight's reader, Angelique Brock, will be sharing a poem she wrote last year while working with WITS writer-in-residence Damon Arundel at West Seattle High School. Please join me in welcoming Angelique Brock, reading her poem, Beige.
Thank you. Beige. My beige is boring. My beige is plain vanilla, uneventful, uninteresting, unexciting, uninspiring. My beige is bland and tired. My beige is as boring as going through the thesaurus looking for all those damn synonyms for boring. My beige is like a blank wall, empty, nothing. My beige is for nothing. My beige is a color people paint their walls because they know it'll go with anything. My beige is the color of a hearing aid lodged in an elderly man's ear. Too senile to fight, he rambles on to no one in particular, wishing for someone to listen. My beige is neutral. My beige doesn't know when to speak up, when to stand up, or how to use its voice. My beige is submissive. My beige is compliant. My beige is too scared to be anything other than invisible. My beige is less than nothing. Because beige has no identity. Beige will not put up a fight. Beige is for white noise and elevator music and the kids who never talk back and for those who don't care. Beige is for never once testing the boundaries and for accepting things as they are. Beige is for faltering at the end of a sentence because you're unsure. Beige is for all the things I hate. And sometimes my beige feels like all the things I am. Thank you.
Thank you, Angelique. We will have copies of Angelique's poem at our information table after the event, and you can also find it on our blog, salblog.org. After a wild week of wild weather, it is an especial delight to welcome Ellen Bass, a ray of Santa Cruz sun, to Seattle. Bass is the author of 8 books of poetry. The first 5 were written in her first incarnation as a poet, which was nurtured in part by an early teacher, Anne Sexton. This first epic also included her co-editing of the groundbreaking anthology, No More Masks, an anthology of poems by women. Then she paused. Her attention shifted to her work as a workshop leader, an activist, and an advocate for survivors of childhood sexual abuse. This period of her life saw her pen several important and influential texts, including I Never Told Anyone, writings by women survivors of child sexual abuse, and The Courage to Heal, a guide for women survivors of child sexual abuse. After a dozen years or so, the desire to reignite her life as a poet was kindled. And so she began again. She learned with the help of her next mentor, Dorian Lux, how to be a poet again, How to Be a Poet Anew. The three books that have resulted include two from our very own Copper Canyon Press, The Human Line and Like a Beggar. Her work is groundbreaking, down to earth. It is in the earth. It gets a little dirty often. It's sexy, ripe, juicy, it makes you laugh, it tells secrets, it invites you in. Bass is a self-proclaimed intimacy junkie, and the poems want to hole up with you in a dark bar and talk about black holes in the universe and how beautiful it all is, even when it's utterly terrifying out there. Bass is ripe with praise. She is melon heavy with odes. Her poems are like the accordion, an image that recurs in the most recent work. They expand and contract. They zoom in and out. They breathe. They make music. Quote, being fully present for our most intense experiences, she has said, is a great challenge, but there is a depth of living that comes from that presence that is perhaps the only true consolation and the source of meaningful action. Robert Frost famously wrote that, quote, like a piece of ice on a hot stove, the poem must ride on its own melting. In other words, the poem's momentum comes from the risks it takes. These are the risks that Bass has been willing to take in service of her poems of gutsy empathy. So pull up a chair, the stove is hot, the ice is cold, and Bass's poems are ready to make you melt. Please join me in welcoming the wonderful Ellen Bass.
Thank you for that intimate introduction. Thank you, everybody at Seattle Arts and Lectures, for inviting me. I'm so happy to be here. And just a special thanks to my Copper Canyon family. Thank you, Angelique. That was a beautiful, real poem. Thank you. Yeah, one more hand for her. And thank you, people of Seattle. I got into my hotel, and this is what I saw. I don't know if you've seen this from Seattle Met, but what it says up here is, this is Sanctuary City, where the Constitution matters, diversity is celebrated, and all are welcome, underlined in red. That's a pretty fabulous thing to see the minute you come into some place. I love Seattle. I come here a lot. And when the traffic was all messed up, I knew how to get on the light rail. I want to read you this passage that was written during World War II by Catherine Ann Porter, just to acknowledge the times that we're in and the place of art. She wrote, "The voice of an individual artist may seem perhaps of no more consequence than the whirring of a cricket in the grass. But the arts do live continuously, and they live literally by faith. Their names and their shapes and their uses and their basic meanings survive unchanged in all that matters through times of interruption, diminishment, neglect. They outlive governments and creeds and the societies, even the very civilizations that produce them. They cannot be destroyed altogether because they represent the substance of faith and the only reality. They are what we find again when the ruins are cleared away." So I'm going to read some poems from that are in my books, but I'm also going to read some new poems, kind of a mixture. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you. Relax. Bad things are going to happen. Your tomatoes will grow a fungus, and your cat will get run over. Someone will leave the bag with the ice cream melting in the car and throw your blue cashmere sweater in the dryer. Your husband will sleep with a girl your daughter's age, her breasts spilling out of her blouse. Or your wife will remember she's a lesbian and leave you for the woman next door. The other cat, the one you never really liked, will contract a disease that requires you to pry open its feverish mouth every 4 hours. Your parents will die. No matter how many vitamins you take, how much Pilates, you'll lose your keys, your hair, and your memory. If your daughter doesn't plug her heart into every live socket she passes, you'll come home to find your son has emptied the refrigerator, dragged it to the curb, and called the used appliance store for a pickup drug money. The Buddha tells a story of a woman chased by a tiger. When she comes to a cliff, she sees a sturdy vine and climbs halfway down. But there's also a tiger below. And two mice, one white, one black, scurry out and begin to gnaw at the vine. At this point, she notices a wild strawberry growing from the crevice. She looks up, down, at the mice. Then she eats the strawberry. So here's the view, the breeze, the pulse in your throat. Your wallet will be stolen, you'll get fat. Slip on the bathroom tiles in a foreign hotel and crack your hip. You'll be lonely. Oh, taste how sweet and tart the red juice is. How the tiny seeds crunch between your teeth.
To officially open our evening, I am proud to introduce one of our youth poet ambassadors, Emrys Foster. Sal launched the Youth Poet Laureate program here in Seattle 2 years ago in partnership with New York City's Urban Word to amplify youth voices. You can visit our info table or lectures.org to learn more. And please join me in welcoming Emrys reading Nautica.
Hey, I'm Emrys. I use they, them pronouns. I'm 15 years old, which by the way means that I am almost old enough to like get a real job, but I'm kind of looking around at the market and like Elliott Bay Bookstore open books. Hi. Okay, anyways. Who has hurt you? The sea. The sea has hurt me, and I shall never recover. Who takes their eyes from morning light and the mists of time long lost? The clock tower, my love, the everything and the nothing, the creatures that feed off your heartbeat, whose veins drip with your tears, the dusty glass jar in the corner forgotten. When will the sun rise? When the night watch ends and the anchor holds strong, the sun will rise red, red warning. How should the moon measure the tides in come and go and leave and stay and wait, return, delay? How should I breathe, sit in the sand and listen to the sea, push, pull, in, out, inhale, exhale until I return? What about love? I am in love with salt and wind and canvas. What about everyone you leave behind? They will be waiting at the dock when the tide comes in. What about tears? Tears are salt and salt like the ocean. When I am on land, I catch my tears and drink them from my cupped palms. I will shed none now. Yours will flow back to the sea, to me. You ask so many questions. What about trust? Marooned in this city as I am, who will find me here? The sea, as it rises, some strange vulture. You ask so many questions. When will my life begin? With the sunrise, with the high tide, I set sail. Marooned on this earth as I am, when will I join the constellations? When I give them my breath and my flesh, when at last I learn how to dance and I take my place in sailors' charts. How should I begin? Hoist the mainsail, reef the canvas, down, over and under, loop, up, over and under, so I don't capsize in the wind. When will my ribs crumple and cave in? When I fall, as I sink through the fading light, and silvery bubbles escape from pale blue lips, one of them carries my superstitions. I can let go of them now. There is no wood to knock on here, only cast iron skeletons. Below my shoulders resides my heart. Below the surface of the water lurk dark shapes and sharp teeth, and ancient, ancient creatures here be dragons. In the beginning, I had nothing. In the beginning, you had everything. Then we had each other, no more and no less. But now I have the reflection of moonlight on water, the pull of the tides, the wind on my face, and the salt-roughened shrouds high above the deck. Because the sea has hurt me, my love, and I shall never recover from the smell of salt and the golden green of murky depths and the curve of horizon tracing the sky from this insatiable thirst for salt water. Thank you.
Thank you, Emrys. We will have copies of Emrys' poem at our information table after the event, and you can also find it on our blog. It is an immense pleasure to welcome the formidable visionary of new forms, Alice Notley, to Seattle. Notley is the author of more than 40 books of poetry. In 2015, she was awarded the Poetry Foundation's Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize, which recognizes the outstanding lifetime achievement of a living U.S. poet. Across forms and outside forms, Notley has invented and reinvented the genre of poetry. She puts the avant in avant-garde. She is post-postmodern. She is always pre-whatever's next. Each poem, each line of each poem feels like it can be read as a manifesto for her work. Quote, "I want to live here where nothing coheres," she writes in one poem. Quote, "Nothing happens, things coalesce, then melt again as if you yourself create them. Well, don't I? I create death and time." She does indeed create as if an all-powerful creature, a force beyond mere mortals, a divine presence. From lyrics to epics to book-length poems, from her groundbreaking work about birth and motherhood, Notley embraces mystery like the visionary poet that she is. Local poet Sierra Nelson, in a beautiful essay for Poetry Northwest that I highly recommend to you, describes seeing Notley read here in Seattle years ago, the last time she was here. She says, "Notley read like a flume," she writes, "a torrential streaming force, almost terrifying yet deeply invigorating, like a dynamic waterfall," or, she quotes, "in a gesture both ecstatic and trembling, like a sudden blaze rushing upward." She quotes Borges, who quoting the pseudo-Dionysus describing the seraphim in A History of Angels. Notley's most recent book, Certain Magical Acts, is a dreamscape. The poems are, as Susan Howe writes, quote, "telepathic thought fields." Notley, in an interview when asked about dreams, said, quote, "Examples of things I like about dreams. You don't have to walk a long way to get somewhere. You see people in them you've never seen before. There is no closure. Poems and songs come to you that you don't have to take the trouble to write. There is a magic place one can go to write poems, thus the title of my new book." In her biography, it is said that she has, quote, "never tried to be anything but a poet, and all her ancillary efforts have been directed to that end." In a poem from Certain Magical Acts, she writes, quote, "I disavow any reason but ink on paper to be viewed in the future by no one. We are lucky tonight to sit at the mouth of the Sibyl's Cave and to perhaps grasp one or two leaves of meaning as they swirl out, to see through the seer's eyes a bit of the future, to be avant, before." Please join me in welcoming Alice Notley.
Hello, I was worried about my water because it was hidden, but I actually have it now. I'm going to read entirely from Certain Magical Acts. I have to make sure it's good. I haven't given a full-length reading from it yet, even though it came out last June. So I am going to begin. Two of Swords. I'm blind with my arms crossed over my breasts, sword in each hand. I seek justice in countervailing sharpnesses. You are in force and you are in force. I can't help but be both of you. I wanted to be able to take a side and will never again. These blades could slice my skin, standing as they do for our fierceness, or should I say stupidity? If I drop both swords and rip off the blindfold, I still can't leave, for I can't leave this world except internally. Who wants to see us anyway? Two parties or two sexes, two countries, armies, or two religions, two debaters, two gladiators, two contenders for one space. Is there such a thing as one space? Don't you want to go with the winners, you ask? I want this noise within me to die down. Democracy isn't efficient, and the only politics I recognize lies between us, undefined, requiring no casting of votes. It asks that we admit we're both present, all present in the same multiform space within me or you. I would never ask that you follow me. I will never acknowledge a leader. I am my president, but also I am everyone trying to be with you because I exist and always have. We thought we were our own. We thought we were our own people for tens of thousands of years. We thought there were others like us, but who identified with a different story, a truly other people. But we are all the people, aren't we? We the people? We have forgotten how to be we the people, someone says. Have we, says another. We, if we're the right we, are the people. We can be we, everyone, in the right thought. We found our own true love when we were young, but we didn't know why we had to do this. Hadn't we always? And now we don't know. Everything we have done, we can come to despise. Dividing us into the we of men and the we of women, for example, and all the other we, the peoples, we, the largest we, are composed of. Can we truly be this most large we of all the people? We are domestic and malicious. We are kind and empty. We are purely stupid, sadistic, mortal. But if that, as we replace us with ever more of us, we will never die. I might like to die someday, someone says. I'm not sure that I don't mind if we die, for I'm not sure what living is in that way that we always seem to be sure, we who ever manipulate what we think, we kids. We loved our mother and our father, for they watched us play without interruption, across the long afternoon and into evening. Then we lost each other to our new families, our most desired we thought. Why do we now want to find each other again, the we of our beginning? Who do we trust the most as we cleave and uncleave and cleave again into successive groups, small and large, in a time we define as us, our history? Our time is only us. Time, the substantial we, epochal and great, as only we can see it, our particulars. In the historical library, one reads our book. Don't you want to know what's real? Don't you want to worship our pitiless exclusion of the times we don't know, can't remember? We found our shores walking across a shallow ocean or rowing in boats. Or we just materialized alongside the people we are most like, who aren't people. Maybe they're people. Maybe the apes are people. And the birds, lizards, and lilies, we say. Fish and algae, the sweet other mammals, the dear ones, the spiders and frogs. We the people who appeared before we were born, for some of us were always there. We found us from before, but there was a long raucous before, and some of us are sad we can't remember it. We have stories to complete, as in our long integrity, though they aren't true, we aren't true, defining ourselves as mammals with digits and brains, attesting to our superiority over other parts of our we. But there is no superiority without our we, without all of us. Without us, we are nothing. Without delicate exhalant flora, we are nothing. Without mists and stars and planets and the creatures who live in our bodies, we are all of us congealed into our definition of we. We go where we live. There is nowhere else. We make ourselves hats and gendered pants and skirts. We are sure we are correct in our details. We are of our times, our class, and our values. Correct as only we know how. And our machines excite us so much that we consider them us. We want them to think and act as us. We are our body of the airplane, the computer, and the car. We are our canon and our rebellion, but that is more of the story we have invented that is urgent, appropriate, and true. We are our songs and films. We are what some of us say that more of us choose. How could we love each other without knowing how from our resemblant forms, our echoing sounds? We can identify ourselves from our pastimes and our loves, for aren't we our loves above all? We hate the ones who are spontaneously different, as if what they loved accused us of unhappiness. We divide then. We don't know which of us are really our ethic or element. We are changeable in our moods, for we are what is. We watch with our eyes of us the squirrel person streak across the road, and with our hands of us, we write words in a notebook of our language. These marks, as on an airplane wing blazing, are words for us to read, though some of part of us can't read. Some part of us is unlettered and describes us by living. Some part of us has no leader, no police, and no protocol. We in that part are above us, are the us to which we'll return. We, knowing the clear-edged poem of the object we see as us, we who act. We could never sit at this kitchen table without our terrible and beautiful past and our poems that tell us who we are. We know ourselves inside the extinguishable light, but we know ourselves in another universe. We are here by our agency, which we cannot remember. A world like a boat passing by, and perhaps another on the dark water. How could we stop being us, even when we leave the jeweled cinema? We are gravely and lightfully blessed. But we bless ourselves. We are our way, but we fight within it and about it. We step on the fragile thread of our way, going about with no other explanation but givenness. This is our gift, but who or what can have given it to us except for us?
To officially open our evening, I am proud to introduce a student from our Writers in the Schools program. This year, Writers in the Schools will work with 26 area public schools and at Seattle Children's Hospital by matching them with local professional creative writers to inspire over 6,000 students to write their own poems, stories, and memoirs. Tonight's reader, Abdelhalali Mohammed, will be sharing a poem he wrote last year while working with WITS writer-in-residence Damon Arundel at West Seattle High School. Abdelhalali's basketball team moved their game this evening to earlier in the evening just so he could read here tonight. So, huge thanks to the team, and please join me in welcoming Abdelhalali Mohammed reading his poem, Holy.
My name is pronounced Abdullahi Muhammad. Holy. The first breath you take and the last exhale of your life. Holy. The song stuck in your head. Holy. From a hug to a kiss to love. Holy. The new jeans you bought. Holy. When you look better in the picture. Holy. From the speed talker to the stutterers, holy. The anger passing through you that no one realized, the time spent with your family and the laughter shared with your peers, the first bite and the last sip, holy.
Thank you. We'll have copies of the poem at our information table after the event, and you can also find it on our blog. It is an abundant pleasure to welcome Ross Gay to Seattle. Ross Gay is the author of 3 collections of poetry. The most recent, Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, was a finalist for both the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award, and also garnered him the prestigious Kingsley Tufts Award. Ross is also a gardener, a painter, a professor, an editor, a basketball player, and a disciple of joy. He is a founding member of the Bloomington Community Orchard, a free fruit for all nonprofit focused on food, justice, and joy. On the connections between poetry and gardening, he has said, quote, "There's probably been nothing else in my life that's trained me to go slow the way gardening has, that's compelled me to look very closely." His work ranges from poems with sapling skinny lines to poems with long lines that vine across the page in tangles of heat wave growth. They are lush, discursive, digressive, funny, meta, sweet, sad. The elegies are odes and the odes are elegies. They are down to earth in all ways, even as they reach skyward. A reviewer wrote, quote, "Ross Gay's 3rd collection is not simply an ode to finding gratitude for the things we usually take for granted. It is a triumphant declaration of love for the world we live in." The title poem is a long piece which Ross has said was begun as a, quote, "way to publicly imagine what it means for a person to be adamantly in love with his life. I wanted to realize joy as a fundamental aspect of our lives and practice it as a discipline." We, friends, are in dark times, and in dark times you plan and hope for light and heat. You pore over seed catalogs, map out your garden, think on summer. Ross Gay's poems nourish us, they tend us, they bring us together, they prune us when we need a little pruning, and they offer us the sugar-rushed pleasure of a fig taken straight from the tree. And perhaps by practicing this kind of joy, even as we resist, we will find our way to some new summer. So please join me in welcoming a master poet, a master gardener, the joyful Ross Gay.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very nice of you. Thank you for that introduction. Thank you for that poem. Beautiful. Beautiful. I know that picture. I know that picture. I want to read you real quickly a poem by someone else. Do any of you know the poet Thomas Lux? Yeah. Yeah. Just died. And he died like 2 days ago, 3 days ago. Yeah. Tom was my teacher. He was probably, I went to Sarah Lawrence College, and I was a real young writer when I went there, and I just didn't know anything. And in my second semester, I took a class with Tom, and he was an amazing teacher, just like a masterful teacher, like could show you, you know, could listen, could be patient with you, and he really taught me how to write a poem. It wasn't like after his class I knew how to write a poem, but he showed me the things that would eventually lead to poems. Anyway, you know, and then I've just the last 2 days been like listening to him on YouTube and, you know, on the Poetry Foundation, and I'm like, my God, like this was one of the people who taught me that poetry as a sort of act of joy, of radical joy, is a real thing. There's a poem called Render, Render. You know, I'm just going to tell you this story real quick. Me and this poet, Patrick Rozal, we were reading down at Georgia Tech at a, yeah. Yeah. We were reading at a Georgia Tech like 10 years ago now. And Tom had a real distinct way of reading. And and we were like at a party after the reading and we were imitating Tom. He was just within earshot, you know. And he was like, he was with a few people and he said, you know, you raise them up like they're your own kids. What do? They mock you. Yeah, so anyway, this is a poem called Render, Render. I'm going to try to read the first line, how he read it. Boil it down. Feet, skin, gristle, bones, vertebrae, heart muscle, boil it down. Skim and boil again. Dreams, history, add them and boil again. Boil and skim in closed cauldrons. Boil your horse, his hooves, the run-over dog you loved, the girl by the pencil sharpener who looked at you, looked away. Boil that for hours. Render it down. Take more from the top as more settles to the bottom. The heavier, the denser. Throw in ache or sperm in a bead of sweat that slid from your armpit to your waist as you sat stiff-backed before a test. Turn up the fire. Boil and skim. Boil some more. Add a fever. Add the virus that blinded an eye. Now's the time to add guilt and fear. Throw logs on the fire. Coal, gasoline, throw two goldfish in the pot. Their swim bladder is used for clearing. Boil and boil, render it down and distill. Concentrate that for which there is no other use at all. Boil it down, down. Then stir it with rose water, that which is now one dense, fatty, scented red essence which you smear on your lips and go forth to plant as many kisses upon the world as the world can bear. He gave a lot to poetry. So I'm going to read to you from this book, Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, with the pretty cover. And you know, my mom, when this book came out, she said, she's like, "Oh, Rosie, that's the best cover you've had yet." I was like, and then I had to tell her, I was like, "Well, that's the only cover I didn't actually paint, Mom." She's a good mom. She's a good mom. This is called Sharing with the Ants. And I have some, you know, a lot of sort of fruit poems, tree poems, gardening poems. So I'll read a few of these. Sharing with the Ants. A euphemism for some yank and gobble. No doubt some yummy tumble or other, like monkey spanking or hiding the salami. Of course your mind goes there, loosey goose that you are. Me too. Me too. You have a favorite? Don't lie. I've heard you say them. Tending the hive, eating the melon. How's the tunnel traffic? Or as a massage therapist would say to my pal when his loneliness dragged him to a carpeted room in an apartment building in Chinatown where the small hands lathered his body, open the door. Naturally, sharing with the ants. Some entomologic metaphor, the chronic yoke in lovemaking, not only of body to body, but life to death. Sharing with the ants. Or the specific act of dragging with the tongue one's sweat-gilded body from the tibia's lookout along the rope bridge of the Achilles, marching across the long planes of the calf and the meticulously unnamed zone behind the knee over the hamstring into use your imagination for Christ's sakes. But I will tell you, it is dark there and sweet, sharing with the ants. But that's not what I'm actually talking about at all. I mean sharing with the ants, which I did September 21st, a Friday in 2012, when by fluke or whim or prayer, I jostled the crotch-high fig tree whose few fruit had been scooped by our fat friends, the squirrels, but found shriveled and purple into an almost testicular papoose. That's a good image. Smuggled beneath the fronds of a few leaves, one stalwart fruit, which I immediately bit in half, only to find a small platoon of ants twisting in the meat. And when I spit out my bite, another four or five lay sacked out, Their spindly legs pedaling slow, nothing. One barely looking at me through a half-open eye, the way an infant might, curled into its mother's breast. And one stumbled dazed through my beard, tickling me as it tumbled head over feet, over head over feet, back into the bite in my hand, the hooked sabers of their mandibles made soft, kneading the flesh, their claws heavy and slow with fruit, their armor slathered plush as the seeds shone above, the sounds of their work like water slapping a pier at night. And not one to disrupt an orgy, I mostly gobbled around their nuzzle and slurp, careful not to chomp a reveler. And nibbling one last thread of flesh, I noticed a dozy ant nibbling the same toward me, its antenna just caressing my face, its pincers slowing at my lips, both of our mouths sugared and shining, both of us twirling beneath the fig's seeds, spinning like a newly discovered galaxy that's been there forever. That's my, what's the word, is it entomology? That's my soft porn entomological poem.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Poets Ellen Bass, Alice Notley, and Ross Gay read from their work at McCaw Hall as part of Seattle Arts and Lectures Poetry Series. You'll find each full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thank you again to Sonia Harris for our recordings. Tune in again soon.